Meeting will come to order. Representative Solberg. I told that this is a 2 minute bill. Representative Lilly, do you want to move this?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Representative Lilly moves House File 3295. Representative Solberg, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is the last stop of this particular bill. It was brought to me by the Grand Rapids East Economic Development Association, which is a form of part of the Grand Rapids City government. They appoint EDA members, and they received a grant from the Brandon Foundation for the purpose of using that money to give low-interest loans to business people, particularly in the downtown area, to be able to fix up their stores. And as in most small towns, it's community people that are on these particular boards. And they discovered that one of the gentlemen who happens to own a glass company, a window company, they found out that he couldn't even participate in not vote or anything else on the EDA. If he was served on the EDA and they gave a grant to a business, he would not be able to sell that business a window. So they brought this to me, and the change in the conflict of interest for the economic development organizations is going to now mirror the rest of the laws on conflict of interest. They've adopted this identical language that people have as it relates to HUD, serving on local HUD organizations and so forth. And it merely says that if you have a direct or indirect potential conflict of interest, you notify people in advance, you refrain from discussing the problem, you refrain from voting, but does not make you ineligible as any other class of citizens. So very similar to what we have as well, and it's identical to those conflict of interest provisions that are in the Housing and Urban Development groups and local units of government. So with that, I think I've explained the bill, the reason for the bill, and would appreciate your support.
Are there any questions on this bill? Is there anybody from the audience who wants to testify? Representative Lilly, we were just consulting with the other side of the issue, and not of this issue. Would you make your motion to change it to send it to the consent calendar?
Yes, I'd be happy to do that, sir.
Thank you. Representative Lilly renews his motion to pass this and send it to the consent calendar. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed, no. Carry.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you.
I got two agenda.
Representative Burns, does yours have, I believe it has to go to finance on phone?
Okay,
that's what Mr. Burden said. Does anybody want to move the Burns bill? Representative Coles moves House File 3498 to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. Representative Burns, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. This is a fairly simple bill. We have in the state a firefighter training and education board. Members who serve on the board are volunteer firefighters, full-time firefighters, chiefs, and there's also public members. And they do not get reimbursement for expenses, nor are they eligible to get per diem. And the per diem amount for almost every state board is $55 per day. So this is just a fairness issue. It allows those members to receive mileage reimbursement and per diem. And as some of you know, I served for 4 years on the governor's staff filling board appointments like this, and we had a hard time often getting people from greater Minnesota to serve. And I can tell you on this particular board, my colleague in the governor's office has extreme hard time, and we have lost members because you have to get someone to volunteer to come to meetings, drive from potentially a very long distance, and not even get mileage reimbursement. And in some cases, firefighters who serve get reimbursement from their city, but I've been told there are other cases where they just have been denied reimbursement. This is something that's consistent for almost every other state board. The funding comes out of the dedicated fund for the fire safety account, not out of the general fund. And with that, I stand for questions. And the state fire marshal is here as well.
Representative Cole.
Mr. Chairman, maybe for staff, is the term compensation that we're using here, is that the term that's consistently used throughout for these boards? I have no problem with the idea of paying mileage and per diem, but the term compensation could be broader than that.
Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cole, I can look it up and see. I don't know. My head.
Mr. Chair, I guess, Mr. Gehring, if you would do that, I'm fine getting this bill out of here, but if that's Representative Burns' intent to provide mileage and per diem, let's make sure that that's what we're doing. We're not setting up something that the board, not that they would, but that they could use to provide something more than that.
Mr. Representative Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Coles. That is a very good point, and I happen to know the statute front and back, and it allows, and I can read it to you if you'd like. It says members of boards may be compensated at the rate of $55 per day on board activities when authorized by the board, plus expenses in the same manner and amount as authorized by the commissioner's plan adopted under 43A.18 sub 2. And there's also a provision that allows if you are getting paid, let's say you're a full-time firefighter, you attend the meeting, and you're getting paid your salary by your city, you cannot get per diem, because that would be double-dipping. So that's an excellent question, and the statute, I think, is very clear on allowing only compensation of $55 a day plus expenses like mileage.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cole.
Representative Salem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Burns. I do support this bill. I think it's a fine bill. But I just want to ask you the question, where do most of these meetings occur? Do you know? Are they in the city?
I believe they are, but I'll have the State Fire Marshal answer that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, Jerry Rosenthal, State Fire Marshal, the current location of those meetings is actually in St. Michael. They have adjusted that based on the location of the members on the board and moved it to that as kind of a central location as opposed to moving them around the state.
Representative Taylor?
Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, thank you. I'm glad to hear that because I think that one of the reasons that we have so much trouble getting people to serve on these committees is indeed because meetings are so often held in the Twin Cities, and that means that people from outstate have a long ways to drive. And I don't always think that's considered when people schedule meetings, and not just for your organization, but for many others. So I just wanted to make a mention of that, and thank you for having them at least in St. Michael. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments, questions? Okay. All in favor of Representative Cole's motion to pass it and refer it to finance, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next one is House File 3374, Representative Bond. Okay. You can tell me before we vote. Thank you, Representative Bond. Would somebody make a motion to... Representative Kranz moves House File 3374. Representative
Thank you.
Representative Kranz also moves the DE1 amendment to get it in the shape the author wants. Is that correct? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carried. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we'll now be operating off the DE1 amendment. In terms of, we did request this amendment on Monday. We don't know why it didn't show up, so you have this copied version in front of you. The first portion of underlining is actually the bill. The slightly bolder underline starting after the word license with the word where is the what was included in the amendment, some additional language, just so it's difficult to read and make it clear to you. Essentially what this bill addresses is basically a small technical bill to correct something that is already done in practice. There was a law passed many decades ago, basically to make sure that civilians didn't get access to radios that could do police frequencies, so that one had to have a permit in order to do that and a legitimate reason to be able to do that. But over these many years, and when we've gone to mobile radio sources, our volunteer fire departments and other fire departments have, as a matter of course, issued and allowed their members in their off-duty time, in their personal vehicles and on their possessions, to have radio equipment that had frequencies, police frequencies, as they would during their jobs. During these many years, for the most part, none of these people have gotten this permit that is stated in law. So the practice has not been consistent with the law for decades. And this technical amendment, this technical bill, is to address that and make sure that our, to exempt our volunteer firefighters, other firefighters, and emergency responders from having to request this permit in order to carry this equipment. So we are just addressing that, and I have with me today the State Fire Marshal Jerry Rosendahl, who will talk about it briefly and also why we have this additional language and what that's addressing. And also, if there are additional questions, I have with me Spring Lake Park, Blaine's, and Moundview Fire Chief Niall Zickman, and he's also the lead for the Coalition of Volunteer Firefighters in the state. So I'll turn this over to State Fire Marshal Rosendahl.
Mr. Rosendahl, try to make it short. I think this is a consent item calendar, so we don't need to spend all morning on it.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, if I could just give you the brief amendment portion, which really deals with the current and going into the future, the use of the armor system, the radio system, 800 megahertz, commonly referred to, where that type of system doesn't actually have the what we'll call old-fashioned frequencies that are licensed to the sheriff or the law enforcement agency. So we're just trying to make sure that we don't have to come back and redo this again in the future. And this language came to us from from the Emergency Communications Network armor system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll stand for questions.
Thank you. Is there any questions? Okay. Let's see. Representative,
I'll renew my motion.
Renew the motion. Is it okay to send it to the consent calendar with you?
Please.
Okay, thank you. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed,
aye.
No. Carries.
Thank you.
Chair Mullery, House File 3408. I believe we're going to the consent calendar, and Representative Cornish over here is itching to make the motion.
Mr. Chair, members, I'll move the House File 3408 be recommended to pass and move to the consent calendar.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. Chair Mullery, to your bill, House File 3408.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This just changes by a month. The time for the report to the chairs of the committees at the witness has disappeared in the last 10 minutes. I didn't see him. Sorry. Looking too far back. Can you real quickly explain that?
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony concisely.
Thank you. My name is David Voigt. I'm a Deputy Attorney General. The reason for the request for an extension of the due date is because the task forces throughout the state all operate on a calendar year rather than a fiscal year, and in order to provide complete information, we ask them to give us an update, and we've had trouble getting enough time to get their information to analyze and digest it and include it into the report by the earlier deadline.
Representative Coles, thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Voigt, this is fine, except I just have a little bit of a concern. March 15th puts us 2 or 3 weeks past the February forecast, and in a budget year when we're considering funding for these types of priorities, I want to make sure that the legislature has all the information, good, bad, or indifferent, as it makes those decisions. I mean, would it be possible to move this back to March 1st? And so I appreciate the quandary you're in, but I want to make sure we have the information as we make the budget decisions.
Mr. Boyd.
I certainly understand that concern, and that's our concern as well, is to provide the best information to the legislature as possible. Any extension will be helpful. As an example, this year, I believe the report was filed just this week. If the committee thinks a March 1st deadline would work better, any extension would help.
Mr. Chairman, since Chair Paymar is not here, I'm not going to make that motion now, but I'll chat with him and maybe with Representative Mullery as we move forward. I just want to make sure we have the information when we make the budget decisions.
Representative Goldberg.
Well, and given the tight deadlines, this would actually be after first deadline in this particular year. Mm-hmm. So if they're agreeable, I think it would be to your group's benefit.
And I think Phil may be around here, but I do think that going to the consent calendar maybe between you just to do the amendment now, if that's okay with you, Representative Mullery. Representative Coles.
On line 1.8, we changed 15 to 1.
Representative Coles moves on line 1.8 to strike the date March 15th and replace it with March 1. Delete March 15th, replace it with March 1. Council has that amendment. Any questions for members? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Amendment adopted. And any other questions for members? Representative Cornish renews his motion that House File 3408 be recommended passing and referred to the consent calendar. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Bill passed. Thank you, Chair Mullery. Representative Bigham, House File 3441. Would you like to move your bill and recommend it to pass and be referred to local government?
Yes. Thank you, Ms. Shapiro. I also do have an amendment that I may move to. I'll move it so it can be put in the order that the bill can be put in the form that I would like to have.
Representative Bingham, the amendment, is still being handed out.
This is the time to vote on it then before anybody reads it. No? That's not how it works?
I think we'll take a moment.
Okay. I can go ahead and explain the bill then.
I believe that members are we just going, Tess is on her own here, so we will, if you could just explain the bill, explain the DE amendment, and then we'll...
I have to explain the bill before the amendment.
Go for it.
But House File 3441 allows for local municipalities to sell public safety equipment, or to donate public safety equipment, and right now that's currently not allowed, and the A8 amendment says you can't intentionally sell basically bad equipment. And those are the two. That's the bill. It's very simple.
Thank you, Representative Bigham. I believe that members should have the AOA 1350 amendment. Anyone not have the amendment? Okay, this Representative Bigham moves the AOA 1350 amendment to get the bill in the shape she would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Amendment adopted. Representative Bigham, having presented your bill, questions from members? Questions from members?
No.
Seeing no questions from members, Representative Bigham, will use a motion in House File 3441, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the local government committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Bingham. Representative Bingham, you also have House File 3505.
Am I going to do my next one, too?
Let's just stick with 3505 for now, Representative Bingham. Would you like to move House File 3505, the recommended pass, and are we going to the General Register?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bingham.
I believe there's a fiscal note on it, so it could go right to the General Register.
Representative Bingham, why don't we move your bill to have it before the committee, and we'll discuss and we'll fix your motion at the end of the presentation. Go ahead and proceed with your bill, having moved it, to have it before the committee.
Okay, thank you. House File 3505 is a bill that was brought to me by the Attorney General's office, and it's a very simple bill, actually. What it does is it allows or prohibits sexual predators from joining social networking groups, i.e. MySpace, Facebook, also those that allow those social networking groups that allow 18 years or younger persons to join. And I will let the second half of the bill be described by Mr. Voigt from the AG's office.
Welcome again to the committee, Mr. Voigt.
Thank you again. My name is David Voigt. I'm a Deputy Attorney General. Seems like every month we hear news stories about a sexual assault of a child where the predator met the victim over the internet on a site like MySpace. Earlier this year, we learned that thousands and thousands of convicted sex offenders had set up profiles on MySpace, and MySpace has made efforts to detect them and remove them. What this bill does is it attempts to prevent the convicted sex offenders in Minnesota from accessing MySpace in the first place. It would make it a violation of the sex offender registration law for a registered offender to access MySpace. The second part of the bill relates to enforcement, and it applies to those sex offenders who have served their prison sentence and are released on intensive supervised release. That the statute already allows for unannounced searches of the person's person, vehicle, or premises. This extends that unannounced search authority to computers and other electronic devices that are capable of accessing the internet.
Thank you, Mr. Voigt. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Bingham, when you testify, I'm curious about the language on page 4 where you talk about that they can't access a social network site and what it does, and that it permits people under the age of 18. Are there social networking sites that do not permit people under the age of 18 that then would be available to these people?
Mr. Voigt, thank you. Something like a dating website may fit the general definition of social networking website on page 2, and the intent of the bill is primarily to protect children, so the bill is aimed at the websites like MySpace and Facebook that do allow people under 18.
I represent Holden.
Mr. Chair, I'm just concerned that there's no way to monitor how old somebody is when they access the website. So I'm still not understanding why you would have the "and permits people." Why wouldn't you just deny access to all social networking websites?
Mr. Voigt.
Well, that would certainly make the bill broader. It's really a policy decision whether you want to make a bill so broad. The Attorney General's intent in proposing this in the first place was protecting children, and that's why the Attorney General chose a more limited approach.
Thank
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Voigt, I don't have any problem at all with the policy that we're discussing here, but my question relates to the same language that Representative Holberg was just referring to. The concern I would have is whether this legislation would stand up to a constitutional a First Amendment challenge. Can you address that? I assume the Attorney General considered that issue as the legislation was being put together, and maybe part of the reason why you narrowed the scope. But can you address that? Because, again, I don't have any problem with the policy, but I don't want to pass this thing and then have it spend 2-3 years in the courts and ultimately get found to be unconstitutional.
Mr. Voigt.
Thank you. Because this applies only to convicted offenders who are subject to the registration requirement, and it's a remedial measure, I don't believe it would be vulnerable to a constitutional challenge. There are some states that have gone further. The state of New Jersey, for example, has recently passed a bill banning internet use entirely for some of their convicted sex offenders. Bills restricting the internet are relatively new, and the law is not well developed. But if you're talking about a First Amendment challenge, the fact that it applies only to convicted offenders, I think would assure that the law would withstand that kind of challenge.
If you hold on 1 second, Representative Coles, appreciate it. Mr. Voigt, I heard you just say the law is not well developed. You were referring to the case law.
Case law, correct.
Being not well developed. Thank you. Not the legislation before us.
Correct.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Voigt. Representative Coles.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Voigt, as much as I would love to strip convicted sex offenders of their First Amendment rights, we don't get to do that. The Constitution still provides them some First Amendment rights. So I don't have a problem with the policy here. I'm going to support the bill, but I just hope the Attorney General's office is prepared to vigorously defend the constitutionality of this, and if the office has prepared any research on this issue that it would be willing and able to share with me or with this committee, I would appreciate that. It's not a formal request, but that's the one issue that I just get a little concerned about, us spending time on this and then getting found to be unconstitutional. Thank you, Mr. Boyce. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Coles. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question related to Mr. Voigt's statement that how broad we want to make this is actually really is a policy decision for this body, this committee, and whatever committees this may go to. And as I'm looking at page 2, lines 2.14 to 2.17, and definition of social networking website, I think about the different venues that sexual predators may have in communicating with others, and it certainly stretches beyond what we currently define as creating web pages or profiles. I know MySpace and Facebook, LinkedIn, various other communication platforms have those options that are in here, but I'm thinking also about certain kinds of online gaming whereby a sexual predator may communicate with another individual during the course of a game that doesn't technically fall under the creation of a web page or profile. I have in front of me which I was just introduced to, model legislation to pursue and control child predators, whereby the social networking website is defined broader, that I think is better language. And I wanted to offer this as an amendment, though I am not prepared to do so today. That it was my anticipation, Representative Bigham, that this was going to finance.
Yes.
Okay.
That's my thought.
And Representative Bigham.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lesh. My understanding is that it is going to finance then be referred to Representative Paymar.
Okay. Well,
Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bigham, I just wanted the opportunity to look at this further and potentially, if we could actually have the option for the committee to expand the definition. I understand the Attorney General would like the definition as it is, but I'd just like to look at this a little bit more. So if it is going to finance, then I'll just withhold any proposed amendments until then, Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Representative DeForest.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. A question for Mr. Voigt. Mr. Voigt, a hypothetical to help me understand the purpose of the legislation. Suppose Joe Smith is a level 3 sex offender subject to this bill. and Joe doesn't create a profile or a web page on a social networking site, but simply just creates a web page and funds it through Google Ads and the like to enhance the profile of the website, would that fall outside the scope of the bill as I read it here, especially looking at page 4 beginning on line 22?
Mr. Voigt?
Well, I think if he created his own website, I think it would fall outside the scope. We're looking at websites like Facebook, websites like MySpace, who offer the opportunity essentially to let people come in and join their online community. Your hypothetical, if I understand it correctly, really could only be addressed by banning the offender from internet use in the first place, or banning the offender from creating an internet page, and this bill is not that broad.
Representative Dillifer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Boy, I agree with you. I share the reading. However, I think I'm going to disagree with Representative Cole. We already essentially strip sex offenders of all, or just about all their rights by committing them civilly, and I'm okay with that. So I'm going to support the bill, but I'd encourage expanding it and banning the internet use then like New Jersey does. And I understand this is a line-drawing issue and reasonable minds can differ, but I'll put myself in the camp of advocating an expansion of this particular bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Voigt, as you know, last year Representative Hilstrom had a wonderful bill that helped to identify internet predators that were not yet in the so-called dragnet in the system, and as we know, six out of every seven sex offenders in the Department of Corrections, that was their first time that they had offended. And I think that Representative Hilstrom's bill did a nice job of actually drawing out those who are not yet in the system and helping us catch them before they do harm. It's sort of the, I think it's NBC that has to catch a predator, I think was their program. This bill would not affect the strength of Representative Hilstrom's bill, but it would only deal with those who are already needing to register already as sex offenders. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's only... It only deals with registered sex offenders. The folks that were caught by Representative Hilstrom's bill and convicted would then be required to register, and then the bill would apply to them after conviction.
Thank you, Mr. Boyd. Any other questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Bingham, we move a motion that House File 3505 be recommended to pass and referred to Finance with a further recommendation to be referred to Public Safety Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. Motion carried. The bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Bingham. Representative Nelson, House File 3503. And while you and the chess players are making the table, members, we have a special guest in the room today. We have students, ninth grade students from St. Louis Park High School participating in the Capital Historical Society's Voice of the People, Your Role in Minnesota Government program. If we could all welcome them to the committee. And students, any questions about the legislative process should be directed to Representative Lesch. After committee, just the actors. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee, for hearing my bill. There is an amendment that needs to get put on it. BCA 08-1215 amendment.
Representative Nelson, not only am I looking for the amendment, I'm looking for the bill, so hopefully the committee minister. Do we have the amendment in our packet? We're not seeing the amendment, Representative Nelson. Students, this is the legislative process at work.
Somebody's going to make copies. I guess I was told that it was given to the committee.
And is it a Representative Nelson? Is it a technical amendment, or is it a delete all or substantive?
it's technically substantive, but it does is it clarifies what's going on, what we're doing here. And I can explain the bill and explain the amendment, and it's all a part and parcel of it. And
Representative Nelson, if it's okay with you,
we can.
I'd like to lay the bill on the table, wait for the amendments to be copied, and move
That's
on to the
great.
Next bill. It's just cleaner, and
That's
I appreciate
great.
Your flexibility. Thank
yeah.
you.
I thought we had it here. I'm sorry.
That's okay. We're laying it over. Excuse me. Sorry. Thank you. Okay, Representative Bingham. House File 3575.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to move House File 3575 to have it before the committee?
Yes, I would, and I also have a DC2 amendment.
And has that been distributed, Representative Bingham?
Yes.
Or is it being distributed now? Pages are distributing the...
Oh, they're distributing right now. I thought it already had been distributed.
Representative Bingham, why don't you present your bill generally. You can refer to the DE amendment, and then we will adopt it once all members have it in their hands.
I have Captain Eckhart up here with me from the Commercial License Division from the Department of Public Safety. We're going to get him going through the bill. Members, this bill is a project of the Legislative Auditor's Report on School District Student Transportation. This bill specifically relates to Type 3 buses, and the DE2 amendment will put the bill in the form that I want it in, and so I will go through that. And the first part prohibits drivers of the Type 3 school buses to not use cell phones while driving for personal use. Personal use of the cell phone while driving, I mean. Sorry.
Captain Eckhart,
I'll turn it over to Captain Eckhart to go over briefly the DE2 amendment, but also he'll probably focus more on the statutes that pertain to this committee because it already has gone through one committee.
Captain Eckhart, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ken Eckhart. I serve as the Pupil Transportation Safety Director for the Department of Public Safety. And this legislation is directed at the drivers that regularly operate what we identify as Type 3 school buses, and what those are passenger vehicles, taxi cabs, vans, or any vehicle that's not outwardly marked as a yellow school bus. And we have about 2,400 of those that operate in Minnesota at any given one time that we inspect. And up until this point, these drivers basically are only required to have a Class C driver's license to operate these vehicles. So this legislation brings in some requirements to ensure that these drivers are not impaired when they transport children, they're physically qualified, they're educated in the needs of child transportation, and they also don't have undesirable backgrounds prior to when they start driving these children. So in a nutshell, those are the four primary areas this bill deals with. And one of the issues here is that school bus drivers with endorsements that operate the yellow school buses are prohibited from having any detectable presence of alcohol when they operate school buses. We want to ensure that these drivers are also prohibited from any alcohol use whatsoever when they operate these Type 3 vehicles.
Thank you, Captain Eckhart. Questions from members? Representative Westrum.
Mr. Chair, Captain Eckhart, and Representative Bingham, can you explain again what kind of buses are these that are going to be driven? It's not the full yellow school buses. I missed that.
Representative Bingham. Mr. Chair and Representative Westrum, no, what it is, it's the small vans, I believe under 12 passengers vans. Captain Eckhart, can you confirm that?
Captain Eckhart, proceed.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westrum, these vehicles are used by school districts and contractors that provide service to school districts, and they can be taxi cabs and passenger cars, pickup trucks, vans, anything, any vehicle that is not defined or outwardly marked as a yellow school bus. And there are about 2,400 of those being operated on roughly on an annual basis in our state that regularly provide transportation for kids to and from school and school-related activities.
Representative Lester?
Chair, and so just a standard driver's license is what they need, but and that you're not changing, but can you review the four criteria as you're saying you're changing? They can't talk on their cell phone. And what are the other ones?
Representative Bigham?
Mr. Chair and Representative Western, yeah, they can't talk on their cell phones, and they teachers and coaches are excluded from this, but they have to go through the standard, you know, how to buckle in, know how the seatbelts work, know how the child safety restraint straps work. I mean, just your normal training when they're transporting students. And if there's any blanks you want to fill in, Captain.
Captain Urquhart? Yes, Mr. Chairman. Representative Weston, the four primary areas are is to prevent impairment, alcohol or drug use by the driver when they're transporting children. Are they physically qualified? And basically what we mean by that is that if they're transporting special needs children or if there's an incident and they need to evacuate children, are they physically qualified to do that? Third is that their background. All school bus drivers that have endorsements go through a background examination, just like the teachers do and the other school employees, to ensure they don't have questionable backgrounds. And then the last, of course, is the list of educational requirements in transporting children, and I think Representative Bingham touched on some of those. How to properly secure children in vehicles, emergency situations, and a number of other things.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Bingham, loading and unloading, like proper, like where to park and where to unload and unload where to stay the passengers. So.
Representative Weston?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bingham, can you identify, has this been a huge problem in our state so far? Can you give us several examples of where the problems lie?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Bingham.
I will let Captain Urquhart describe.
Captain Urquhart.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrum, Senator Olsen chaired a school bus safety committee during the interim, and these issues were discussed at length, and this primarily stemmed from a fatal crash involving a young special needs child right near where I live in Forest Lake.
Mm-hmm.
She was being transported in a van by a contractor contracted to the school operating a Type 3 vehicle. He was deemed to be under the influence of marijuana at the time of the crash, and he actually ran into another school bus, both killing himself and the 14-year-old child. And the family has testified a number of times, both in the Senate and here in the other committees. And these things have come to light, and so this is this started with the Senator Olsen, and this is not a department piece of legislation, but I've been asked here to testify on the technical question.
And Mr. Lester,
tell me how this would have changed that outcome, because it sounds to me from the fact you just said he was already breaking the law. What would have changed under this scenario if he wasn't obeying the law? How would that change the outcome?
Captain Urquhart.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Weston. Well, first of all, under the drug testing requirements, contractor would have detected his drug use. The other thing is, if his background was in question, he had quite a lengthy background. They would have also detected that he was a risk in that area. So I think that if this was in place, this driver would have never been in that vehicle transporting that child that day.
Okay.
So one last Western statement, Mr. Chair, Representative Bingham. I'm just wondering, had school administrators and others weighed in? Because I understand the issue at hand, but at some point, in small districts, you have maybe some older retired people that want to do some of this, but as soon as you start adding a bunch of restrictions or a bunch of training or a bunch of qualifications, you eliminate the employee pool significantly, and
I'm just wondering if this balance, if this bill really doesn't find a balance or happy medium, because the other thing that strikes me is some retired people maybe physically, or maybe they've got a bum leg or something. They certainly are very qualified to drive, but now they're not going to be able to drive these vans anymore.
Mr. Chair, representing from the school district administrators, I don't know if I have the correct title. It's Grace Schwab, is the government relations person, is supportive of this. I have a letter here from the Minnesota Association of People Transportation in support of the bill with the delete all amendment and what? And there's other organizations out here that would be willing to come up and say that in support of the bill. So this is, has been thoroughly vetted, and also I think the legislative auditor, who's in Mr. Nobles, is in the audience. I mean, this is a very thorough recommendation, the report, and so we're, you know, working with a lot of different organizations, Representative Westrom, to find that balance.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Larson, question, Representative Brigham, can you define, who's going to do this training, first of all? Is it going to be now the school district that has to do this, or I suppose the contractor, the contract with the, can you tell me what disabilities aren't going to be allowed now to drive the buses and which ones are?
Captain Urquhart, or...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westrom, basically, if it's a contractor providing the transportation in a contract with the school district, they would be required to comply to these items. If it's a school district that's going to utilize these types of vehicles, then the school district will hold that responsibility. And as you look at physical qualifications, define what's going to exclude someone, well, they would have to demonstrate they would be able to provide these types of services. If they can't demonstrate that, then that might exclude that person from being able to drive. This legislation is really directed at the folks that regularly transport students to and from school and school-related activities, either by the school district or the contractor. It doesn't deal with the parent that transports their own students or the occasional transportation that might be provided by a teacher or another school employee. So these are folks that are in the business or are transporting kids every day for that purpose.
Mr. Testifier, Representative Weston, so I'd like to hear from this gentleman. Welcome to committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony as concisely as possible.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Michael Widener. I am the attorney for Twin City Transportation. They were the company that was involved in the accident up in Forest Lake. We have been very active in working with Senator Olsen and the committee hearings that he had at that time, and working with the family, the State Patrol, in finding a bill that we felt was beneficial to the industry, and also put the children's safety primary. We understand that there are some expenses that will be incurred by companies in this matter. Those expenses we do not see as an obstacle in providing safety. The training requirements, the physical requirements, the drug testing requirements. We actually have asked Senator Olsen for the drug testing requirements because right now in our industry there is no safe harbor and no requirement to drug test. And by having this legislation, it mandates drug testing, and that goes statewide, putting all the children on the same level playing field. One of the things that you don't have here testifying today is the family of Amanda Berglund, and they have testified previously. And one of their concerns was they did not know that when their child went in a minivan, that driver was not subject to the same requirements as a school bus driver. And those requirements being physical ability, training, drug testing, and that was their big concern. They did not know that by their child receiving special transportation, that they were not in the same caliber as every other child that takes a school bus, and that's what this legislation is intended to do.
Thank you, Mr. Widener.
Captain Urquhart and Mr. Widener, I represent Park City Forest Lake School District, and I've spoken repeatedly with Senator Alcine about the work that has gone into this bill, and I know that the testimony has been just very emotional and gut-wrenching, and what the family's been going through, the Bergman family, and I, having sort of vicariously been through this process, I think that it's a reasonable response, and I appreciate that all the stakeholders being at the table and working out the administrability of it, both from the state level and from the local level, and I think that it will prevent further accidents and further deaths like we've seen the tragedy in the Bergman family. So I appreciate everyone's work and Representative Bigham carrying the bill over here. Representative Weston, do you have any further questions? I would like to move on to the next bill.
I understand, Mr. Chair. I guess my parting comment would be, I agree with the drug testing. I mean, I think we actually should use this as a model, and we've talked about it around here. We should drug test these employees. We should drug test people getting welfare benefits. I mean, this is getting to be an out-of-hand problem, and it's time to address that issue. My concern, and to the author, and as you progress, is that you have it narrowly tightened enough to where it's not going to exclude people because of their age or a bum leg or some issues that, you know, if you're in an accident, you aren't assured that the driver's going to even not get injured. And so at some point, the focus should be on whether they can do the job of driving and not the extreme what-if situations in an accident, because you don't know who's going to be injured in an accident or not. And so I just hope we don't get so restrictive that it gets to be hard to find drivers to do this job, and especially in rural communities. We don't have near the number of kids to transport, and so sometimes it has to be a part-time or a limited job. But I'm glad to see there's some exemptions with teachers and other coaches and things like that. But that's just my overarching concern, that it's not too broad, and maybe we should expand the drug testing to even our welfare recipients.
Thank you, Representative Weston. Representative DeLaForest?
Representative Weston, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bigham, I understand the jurisdiction of the committee, but I'd like to just have you briefly explain if there are any increased costs, as I appear there will be, to implement this bill, and who absorbs those costs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bigham, I have not been made aware of any of the organizations that they feel there will be an increased cost.
Representative. No further questions.
My understanding.
Okay, Representative Bigham moves for passage and it be referred to the general register.
Mr. Chair, I need my DE2 amendment move.
Representative Bigham moves her. That was never moved?
No.
Representative moves the DE2 amendment to get it in the shape she wanted in the beginning. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carried. Representative Bigham now moves her House File 3575 as amended for passage and re-referral to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No. Carried. Representative Nelson, do you want to come back? Where are
we? Thank you, Mr. Chair, and hopefully you now all have the amendment. I watched them being distributed with my chicken scratching on it, so.
Representative Nelson. Okay. I'm told that. What's this? The 12th. Move that first.
Representative Nelson, you want the 1215 amendment moved?
That's going to be to delete all amendments, and then there's additional language that has to be amended to that. It's a handwritten one there.
Mr. Gehring, can we call this some kind of an amendment number?
Mr. Chair, you could call it, say, a one amendment if you just throw that on the top right-hand corner.
Okay.
Maybe refer to it as the A1 written amendment, handwritten amendment.
Okay, Representative Nelson, somebody want to move the 1215 amendment? Representative Simon moves the 1215 amendment. And then Representative Simon, you want to move the A1 amendment? Well, we'll have to vote first on the 1215. All in favor, say aye. Aye. Representative Westrom?
Could we find out what the amendment does before we vote on it?
Well, Representative Westrom, it's to get it in the shape that the author wants it in, so normally we allow that right off the bat, and then we discuss it after we've adopted.
All right, well, I'm still looking for the language, but go ahead.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Now, Representative Simon moves the A1 amendment to the 1215 amendment to get in the shape he wants it in. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Nelson, would you explain
Mr. Chair.
Combined amendments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. And what this bill is doing is to correct an inadvertent mistake in a pension bill that was passed last year and dealing with duty disability. I have Bill Gillespie here to explain the bill and what it's about, but it's an inadvertent mistake that was made and give some of these people that were hurt on, police officers and firefighters that were hurt on duty, access to health care that they had before.
Mr. Gillespie, could you do the dance before?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's one day, one time only.
Okay. Mr. Gillespie, go ahead.
Would you like me to speak directly to the amendment, not the bill itself?
Yes.
The amendments are, in fact, a change in the avenue by which those officers who are not in PERA but are in a relief association, there are still a few private individual police relief and fire relief associations. Those folks need to apply, have a way to get to the additional benefit of the insurance coverage. So they were, we kind of forgot about them. So that First Amendment A1, that gives them the ability then to seek and receive the continued insurance premium payments by the local employer. The Second Amendment, the First Amendment, 1215, really should probably be explained in the more global aspect of the bill itself, but what it really does is permits the PERA determination of what is duty disability to be the finder of fact as to whether you qualify for the continued insurance coverage. So that's what the First Amendment does, and it's an insertion, and then if you wish, I would explain the bill in its totality.
Go ahead, Mr. Gillespie.
A number of years ago, this legislature passed legislation which provided that local employers would have to continue to pay the employer's portion of the premium for health insurance payment for those public safety officers, police officers and firefighters, who were either killed in line of duty or were injured in the line of duty and unable to work, as police officer firefighters. What happened over time since that passage, since 1997, is a series of court cases expanded in the pension realm what duty disability was to include basically showing up for work. Anything that happened to you after that was duty disability. And we made some changes in the pension law a group, a coalition of stakeholders through PERA made some changes, and we've seen a dramatic drop. We had folks who used to qualify for duty disability who injured themselves moving boxes in their office. And that was never what the intention of the of that provision was. The intention of that provision clearly was to provide a benefit for police officers and firefighters who were injured before they got 20 years of service on and who could no longer perform those duties and therefore didn't qualify for a regular service disability. What we ended up with then is this expanded duty disability definition, which pretty much took the ability of PERA to manage that aspect of the pension system and trashed it. So we made those changes. We gave a new definition of what is duty disability. It's been very effective. Where we used to see 50 to 60 of these requests or applications for duty disability, we see 3 or 4. So obviously it's very, very effective. And where we're at right now is we just need to have a finder effect, because in July of 2008, the panel that was established to review these requests for this insurance benefit goes out of business. And we need a finder effect. We feel that PERA is the natural source for that decision, and that's what this bill and these two amendments do.
Thank you for wrapping it up quick. Is there any further discussion by anybody? Seems pretty non-controversial. Okay, Representative... did you? Representative Simon's motion to pass as amended to the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee.
Representative Filkey's bill is again laid over. Representative Walker, are you ready? Would somebody move? Representative Saylor moves House File 3564. Representative Walker, I believe, are these your amendments? Or
Mr. Chair, yes, the department has one, and then there's a fix from an amendment that went on in a different committee, and then I don't know about the other one. So I actually have the A6 amendment and the A7 amendment, which there needs to be an all amendment to. Mr. Chair, the A08 amendment no longer needs to be done today.
Representative Walker, you want the A6?
The A6, yes.
And the A7?
Yes.
And what else do you want?
No, them are the only two that I need. I don't know if other members have
any. Okay, the 1326 is not yours then?
The 1326 is something that the county is going to work on this summer with, so we don't need it.
Okay. Can they go on both at the beginning?
Mr. Chair, we can move the A6 if someone would be so kind to move that for me.
Representative Saylor moves the A6 amendment to get in the shape the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Saylor moves the A7 amendment to get in the shape the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, there's an amendment, an oral amendment to the A7.
Okay, we'll move the amendment to get it on, and then you can amend it. All in favor? To get it in the shape? Representative Walker, what did you say?
Let me make double check.
No.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I need to delete line 1.3. That's deleting. So to reinstate line 10 on.
Representative Walker, you want to delete?
Wait. No, that's not right. Go ahead and introduce and say that.
Ms. Huggall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This was what the amendment does is delete a sentence, and we realize it's somewhere else in the bill also, so it's just catching it in both places. So the amendment would be on page 10, line 17, to delete the new language. That would be the amendment to this amendment.
What?
To the A7 amendment. Mr. Chair, I think you could do it separate, if it's easier for staff.
I believe Representative Walker, yes, that's much easier than.
Okay.
So where do we stand now? We can
move the A7 amendment.
We can move the A7 amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All in favor of the A7 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Okay.
And then, Mr. Chair, the oral amendment would be on page 10, line 17, delete the new language.
I'm sorry. Representative Walker, would you say that one more time?
Yes, on page 10.
Of the bill.
Of the bill.
Okay.
On line 17.
Okay.
Delete the entire new language. A police report or criminal complaint alone does not meet this standard.
On page 10, line 17 of the bill?
Of the bill. The first engrossment. You don't have
okay.
The first engrossment.
We do not have the right engrossment here, somebody.
Okay. It is section 8.
We Representative Walker, we do have to have the I think the engrossment to work off of, don't we, Mr. Herring?
Yeah.
Yes.
What would you like to do, Mr. Chair?
I think we're going to have to lay this over till we get the correct engrossment. Don't you think so, Dennis? Yeah. It's just not fair to members to have no idea what's in front of them. Yeah, we're going to lay that over, and then hopefully we'll have it back. Representative Olin has two short bills. Representative Olin, which do you prefer first? Let's do the revisers.
No. Yeah, you can do it. It doesn't matter.
Well, what?
What?
What's going on? Olin, you're going to do your other bill. Can you? Well, I guess we can get it out quickly.
Oh, I don't have that one yet?
No. We'll have it, Representative Olin. Why don't you give an overview of it, and then.
Well, the overview I'll give is just to introduce the fact that I've got the honor of doing the entire revisor's bill today. And I'm going to let the revisor's office do most of the talking after last. They can better explain where they're going than I can.
Ms. Timmons, could you?
Yes.
I think it's out everywhere now.
Mr. Chairman and members.
Just a second.
I'm Michelle Timmons, the revisor. Oh,
wait. Now that it's out, Representative Olin can move his bill, House File 3928. Go ahead, Ms. Timmons.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, I'm Michelle Timmons, the Revisor of Statutes, and what's before you today is the annual revisor's bill that we prepare during every interim as we're doing our editing. We find numerous errors. We also have errors called to our attention by state agencies, lawyers, Senate counsel, House research staff, and we put these together in one bill. And these are the types of errors that are non-controversial, cleanup matters. We do not intend to change any policy with these amendments. They are merely corrections. The bill this year is divided into five articles. Article 1 is the longest, and it contains largely cross-reference errors, where the statute's cross-referenced to another statute, and we simply have the wrong statute number. So we're fixing that. There are other errors in that article, such as erroneous grammar, or the wrong name, where perhaps a board, the name has changed, typographical errors, things of that nature. So Article 2, moving on, relates to data practices. Some years ago, the legislature asked us to, following the substantive portions in Chapter 13 that deal with particular data practices issues, to then create some cross-references that draws the attention of the reader to data practices provisions codified elsewhere in the 25,000 pages of statutes. And so what we do annually is we add new cross-references as the legislature has passed new data practices sections not codified in Chapter 13. So that's what Article 2 does. Article 3 is essentially a name change from a water pollution control revolving fund to the Clean Water Revolving Fund. Article 4 relates to collateral sanctions from criminal convictions. And we now have a very similar project to what we do with data practices. The legislature in 2005 asked us to create a new chapter pulling together and cross-referencing all the collateral sanctions from criminal convictions that, again, are scattered through those 25,000 pages worth of statutes. So Article 4 adds new cross-references for new collateral sanctions added last session. And finally, Article 5 is to correct an error that the Revisor's Office made in publishing a session law last year. We inadvertently did not get the correct final amendment that had been passed by the Senate into our publication. Fortunately, the House and Senate journals did do it right, and the law is very clear that we're a journal state. So, and the journal control. So what we're doing to clean up our publication is simply making the changes consistent with that last amendment so that it will be published appropriately for historical research purposes. With that, I just want to say that I have two staff members in the audience, Janet Rahm, the deputy revisor for editing, and also Carla Reilly, who we pulled out of retirement to help us deal with the allus by another staff attorney. They've both worked on the bill. I wish to thank them, and if you have specific questions, I may need to call them up to assist me.
Questions from anybody on this bill? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Olin will renew his motion. I'm sorry, Representative Olin. Renews his motion for passage and be referred to the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Olin, do you want to present your next bill? Representative Olin, I assume you want to move 3531.
Yes, I'd move 3531 here, Mr. Chairman.
I keep wanting to call you Your Honor, but it's too used to that yet, even though I've been away from that for a while.
Representative Olin, go ahead and present your bill.
Okay, basically, what this bill does is extends the period of time for somebody's registration on a criminal sexual conduct charge to cover the fact that they're incarcerated or commit a new offense while they're presently out. It would extend their time to cover those periods of time.
This is originally requested, and this is actually being brought on behalf of the Predatory Offender Registration Unit of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and I have Anne-Marie Joshan O'Neill here to testify on it.
Ms. O'Neill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Anne-Marie O'Neill from the BCA Predatory Offender Registration Unit, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. As you are familiar with, in 2000, as part of the Katie Poyer legislation, the legislature added Subdivision 6 to the registration statute. And the purpose of Subdivision 6 was to restart the registration period of any offenders who are arrested, convicted, and incarcerated for a new offense, or have their probation revoked and are incarcerated as a result of that revocation. And since 2000, over 6,000 offenders have had their registration period impacted by this subdivision. And now we're in our eighth year, and what we're starting to see is some offenders challenging having their registration period restarted. And we are here at the suggestion of the Attorney General's office because there are some issues with the plain language of the statute. Specifically, the way the statute is worded, it appears that the incarceration has to happen after the conviction. And where we're getting challenges is in two different categories. The first category is a person who's arrested for a new offense and serves their jail time and sometimes significant amounts of jail, 6, 8, 9 months, before they're actually convicted. And then at the time that they're convicted, the judge says credit for time served and the person is released. And some of those offenders are now starting to challenge whether that restarts their registration period because they served the entire period of incarceration before the conviction. The second category of offenders that we're starting to see are offenders who are on warrant status for significant periods of time. So in other words, someone who was required to register from 1998 until 2008, and if that individual in 2006 is arrested for a new offense, does not show up for court, and is on warrant status for 2 or 3 years, then becomes convicted and incarcerated for that new offense, those individuals are now challenging the restart of their registration period because they were able to avoid arrest until after their registration period was scheduled to be completed. So we're looking for some technical changes just to clarify when the registration period should be restarted and that it does apply to time served before the conviction, and it does apply to time served after the registration period was scheduled to be ended, but when the arrest occurs before the registration period was ended.
Representative Olin, I believe there's an A1 amendment. Yes. Do you want that to get in the shape you want?
I would have to move the A1 amendment, too. It wasn't passed out at the time I made my original comments, so I waited.
Thank you, Representative Olin. All in favor of the amendment to get in the shape the author wants, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carried. Go ahead. Is there any further
testimony? I don't believe there's any further testimony.
Okay. Is there any questions from anybody or discussion? Okay. Representative Olin renews his motion to pass as amended and refer to the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carried. Who? Oh. Where's Representative Walker gone? There. Representative Walker, I think what we're going to do is have you explain the bill and then we won't act on it until we have the proper engrossment.
Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you. And I have some department help.
Go ahead, Representative.
Good morning. I'm Christine Vortheim with the Department of Human Services, Division of Child Safety and Permanency. My plan is to walk through the sections that pertain to primarily the adoption statutes 259 that would be of interest to this committee. The other part that we talked about will actually be part of the amendment when we have that available. What I'd like to do that suits the committee is actually discuss the several sections of this bill. They're fairly simple but I'd like to discuss them kind of together rather than each section separately, if that's, if that works out. Section 11, 13, 14, 20, 21 through 23, 31, and 49 ensure continuity of language throughout the adoption statutes, so that they specify when language should apply to a child adoption, to an adult adoption, or an adopted person, often striking the word child and replaced with the word person. Section 12 adds the definition of an adult adoption. Section 15 simplifies the process for an adult adoption, limiting the requirements to a petition, the adult's consent and a decree, and it eliminates the requirements of an adoption home study and a post-placement assessment. Section 16 adds a statutory reference that studies may be paid for through the Public-Private Adoption Initiative, and it clarifies background study requirements in the case of step-parents and relative adoptions. Section 17 provides standardized requirements for an adopted child's social and medical history and clarifies who receives a copy of that history. Section 18 amends the statute about access to the putative father's registry, allows the county agency earlier access to this registry to facilitate engaging fathers when the child is involved in child protection. Section 19 provides that guardian ad litem have access to adoption home studies. Sections 24 through 26 amend adoption assistance to eliminate the annual affidavit, and that's to bring it into compliance with federal language. It clarifies that the commissioner has the authority to collect overpayments of adoption assistance. It also complies with federal language to support relatives by waiving recruitment efforts, and it serves as state definition of special needs is consistent with the federal definition. Section 27 amends the provisions to withdraw a state ward from the state adoption exchange, and basically this makes the language consistent with 2007 legislative change that eliminated an affidavit of child over 14 on adoption. Sections 28 through 30 streamline access to the original birth record to allow Minnesota Department of Health directly to exchange information with county social service or private adoption agencies rather than requiring that all searches pass through the Department of Human Services. Anyway, that's the sections on 259.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Would you like her to walk through the amendment that you do have in front of you, the A6 amendment, because it is a lengthy amendment?
Yes, Representative Walker.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
The purpose of the 260D amendment is to govern voluntary placement. When a local county social service agency and parent plan together for a child with developmental disabilities or mental health problems to receive treatment, the child's parents and the agencies must enter into a voluntary placement agreement. And then federal law requires court reviews when children are in any out-of-home placement. The proposal actually does not change current law, but it clarifies that children are to be provided with the level of care necessary to treat the symptoms of the disability or mental health problems. It makes clear that parents and children visit while the children are receiving that treatment, that parents maintain their parental rights and responsibilities, that court reviews focus on the efforts of the agency and parents to plan together to ensure the child's safety, medical, and well-being needs. There's also changes to 260C that basically transfer the current policy and legal requirements about voluntary placement from 260C to this new chapter 260D. And essentially, the chapter lays out the voluntary foster care requirements, that it's a means for the county agencies and parents to provide needed treatment, that confirms that the chapter does not apply when a child requires protective services. It establishes court review requirements. It maintains the parent's legal authority and ensures the parent's ongoing responsibility to plan and maintain a relationship with their child.
Is there any other testimony? Does anyone else want to testify on this bill? Okay, we're just getting the Proper and Grossman out. Are you coming up to testify on it? Or?
I don't know, Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker, do you know?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if
if Article 2, the data privacy, is part of your committee or not.
Yes, it is.
Then yes.
Oh. Members now have the correct version in front of them. So, Representative Walker, why don't we now go ahead with
the amendment?
We didn't say which one. We didn't say. So, Representative Walker, I believe now we have the proper 3564, and we've adopted the A6 and A7 amendments.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And then you were going to do an oral amendment.
On page 10.
Okay. Go ahead, Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On line 17, if you can delete the new language.
A police report or criminal complaint alone does not meet this standard?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It's the line that was neglected to be on the A7 amendment.
Representative,
what the county attorneys want.
Representative Taylor moves that the new language, Mr. Gehring, what's the appropriate term for new language? Is that?
Delete the new language.
Just delete the. Representative Taylor moves that we delete the new language on line 10.17. To get in the shape the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Anything else?
Mr. Chair, the bill is in the way that I need it. We do have someone here that I guess has an issue with Article 6.
Okay, Ms., would you state your name for the record?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Sally Fashions, and I work for the Department of Human Services as a manager in the Program Assessment and Integrity Division.
Okay, would go ahead. Fashion, I believe.
Pardon me?
Fashion?
Fashion.
Okay.
Yes. Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm going to talk about sections 1, 4, 5, and 6 in Article 2, data privacy. Sections 1 and 4, I'm sorry, I mean, it's 1, 4, 5, and 6 that I'm going to talk about. In sections 1 and 4, we're proposing to expand the definitions of criminal justice agencies in section 1302 and law enforcement function in 1382 to include fraud and crime investigation units operated or supervised by DHS. And what this basically will do is restore access for DHS and counties to the Department of Corrections statewide supervision system and expands access to other law enforcement systems. It also clarifies access for other fraud and criminal investigation functions within DHS, such as state-operated services.
Okay. My understanding is you're explaining, you're not objecting to
yes, Mr.
the language.
Correct.
Okay. Just go ahead then.
Okay. In Section 5, we're proposing to amend Statute 246.13. In that section, Section D outlines the Commissioner's authority to have access to and disclose certain medical and criminal data as provided in the statute. And what we're proposing is under Item 5 to expand that to include under DHS investigations of suspected fraudulent or criminal activities or violations of conditions of probation, supervised release, or conditional release. And then the final section is to amend 256.01 Subdivision 2, which outlines duties and powers of the commissioner, and it would be to clarify the authority of the commissioner to investigate fraudulent and criminal activities involving or impacting human service programs and facilities operated by state-operated services.
Okay, are there any questions on Ms. Fashion's section of the bill, or Representative Holberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm concerned by making the Department of Human Services defined as a criminal justice agency, that we may really expand their access to data. And I think this is something that should actually have a pretty good look-see. It's probably not the time and place, given what's on the agenda and the chairs. So I'm sorry that we weren't made aware of this ahead of time. I know that some of these areas where you're amending, we did give the Department of Commerce certain standards for their investigative powers, but we did not classify them as a criminal justice agency. And so I think there may be some really severe unintended consequences of giving them the standing of a criminal justice agency in Subdivision 1. If you look, you can see on the bottom of page 62 and top of page 63, we give limited authority to the Department of Commerce for their fraud investigation unit. And that's where we had human service also in that area. And so you'd have to make a pretty strong case why that isn't enough authority and why you need to be classified as a criminal justice agency. That would be my first point. And, Mr. Chair, I don't know what your pleasure is with this, but I've got a number of questions related to this section of the bill.
Let's see if we can deal with them here. Or Representative Simon, do you will have any suggestions since you're chair of the practices?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I agree with Representative Holberg. This is something that must have gotten through the cracks in terms of something that might have been referred to the subcommittee. And I don't really care about the subcommittee so much as just that it gets vetted. I mean, it doesn't have to be us, but someone should. And I just think we do need an explanation. I think Representative Holberg is right. This is a pretty big step. I could be convinced, but I'd like to hear why.
Mr. Chair, if I might, maybe what we could do is, at this point, delete Article 2 from the bill, hold it here, and then match it up when we move the omnibus bill. And then that would give us some time to really work through it. And it is part of Chapter 13. It fits within the data practices omnibus bill. And then we can have some conversations between now and when that bill is being put together.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holbrook, I'm hearing three wonderful vehicle bills for the department. It's all kinds of wonderful things have been happening to me on the way. So I would not be surprised if that was your motion. I was not surprised, but I do think the department, just regardless of the action that the committee takes, that you do give the department a chance to explain why they are moving this article.
Fashion very shortly, because it sounds like you're probably not going to convince the members, but go ahead, very short.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. Up until recently, we did have access to the database that I referenced, the statewide supervision system of the Department of Corrections, using the reference under 1382, and what we were told by the Department of Corrections is that unless we were also listed under 1302, we could no longer have access to that database. So it's at their request that we're asking to be put under 1302 as a criminal justice agency in order to continue to have access to that database.
And Mr. Chair, again, I would just recommend the request that we delete Article 2 from the bill here today, and it can catch back up if you need it in this bill at a certain point in time, or it can be left with data practices omnibus bill. But I really don't think that this committee has, in general, the interest as a group, nor the time to really chew through this today.
Looks like people are, is there any comments on that, or Representative Walker,
I think
Mr. Chair, I'm amenable to anything. I actually took the question, and then you or Representative Simon can be responsible for this article. It's great. so I will support the motion to divide, to take out Article 2 and lay it on the table. One less thing for me to worry about on the floor.
Representative Holberg moved to delete Article 2 from the bill.
Mr. Chair, is that the motion? Is it a delete or is it to divide to lay that part on the table so that it's the bill, that part of the bill is still in this committee?
Mr. Chair, I don't think a bill can be segmented and moved in parts, so I think we actually have to delete it. The rest of the bill moves along.
It'll just, Representative Walker, I think the intention is that we have not yet taken up the data practices bill, and so the intention, I believe, of both Representative Simon and Representative Holberg is to look at it, stick it onto that as to what they can agree on.
Mr.
Chair, thanks. And just for the record, so we make it clean, I think Mr. Gehring is communicating that, we can have this drafted as an amendment and just append it onto that bill when it comes here.
Right. My statement of Representative Holberg's motion is correct, that the motion is to delete Article 2. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Mr. Chair, I just need 60 more seconds for 3 more sections for the record for your committee.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Swenson-Clatt. I'm also with the Department of Human Services in the Child Care Quality Unit. And if you would like, I can cover, it describes sections 2, 3, and 7 of Article 2.
Yes. Representative Watson, Article 2?
Article 2 of the data privacy.
Why would we describe what we've deleted?
You know what? Nope, you don't need that.
Okay. Representative Walker, then I think...
I'm done, Mr. Chair.
That's what I thought.
Questions that members may have.
Is there anybody else that has any testimony from the audience? Okay, do members have anything? Okay, all in favor of
motion is all we're voting on right now, right?
No, you've already passed.
That already passed.
This is on the bill itself?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I do have questions on the bill itself.
Okay, Representative Holberg.
I can't find it, given this is a new version here, but can you tell me what you do to the rights of a birth parent's anonymity relative to adoption?
Representative Walker.
Hold on, Mr. Chair. Representative Colbert.
And if somebody could tell me what section of the bill is now.
Ms. Borsham.
Could you please repeat the question?
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, if somebody could tell me where and if there is anything in this bill that affects the anonymity of a birth mother or father in the process of an trying to get information.
Ms. Walker? I mean, Representative Walker or Ms. Borsham.
I'm wondering if it is in section 17. Wait, let me make sure. Do I have... I'm trying to make sure that my...
Mr. Chair, understanding it's the old section 23, but...
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I love our staff. There's nothing in there. House research said there's nothing in there.
So, in other words, there's nothing in this bill, just to get on the record, that if a person gave up a child for adoption and they do not want to be contacted, there's nothing in this bill that would enhance or expand the current rights of adoptees to that information.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I got lost for a moment. The answer is you're correct. I do know that you'll be taking up that issue this evening, and I know there was interest in putting something on this particular bill through the committee process, but the department has not moved any language themselves on that, and thus far no amendment dealing with that issue has come onto this bill.
All right.
Okay, all in favor of Representative Saylor's motion? Does this go to the floor?
It's to the general register, Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker?
It, Mr. Chair, to the general register.
Okay, that's what I thought. Representative Saylor renews her motion to pass as amended and refer it to the general register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee, for your time and consideration.
Representative Tingle said House File 3449.
What happened to it?
The other one for 3448. Can you come up here?
Hi.
I misspoke. Representative Single said is doing the House File 3448 first, and
I would make a motion.
Representative Shellstrom will make a motion to pass 3448, and does that go to Representative Finkelstead? Does that go to the general register, or goes to the general register? Thank you. Go ahead, Representative Finkelstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I've been at the legislature for 12 years, and what brought me to the legislature was infertility and adoption issues after my husband and I had gone through that in the early 1980s. I've chief-authored all the adoption legislation here at the Capitol the last 12 years, and it's been a pleasure to work with various volunteer groups in updating laws regarding that. I know that many of you have been getting emails this morning. These are just the emails I got from 8 to 10 o'clock this morning in support of this legislation. And there's been a lot of work.
Representative Tingle said you don't produce emails like Representative Cornish.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. But this legislation, which regulates surrogacy, has been around for several years, and I've worked closely to have compromise language so that it would deal with the issues here at the Capitol. And in Minnesota, there's about 1 in 8 people who are infertile, which is about 145,000. And I know you have handouts coming around that gives more information on this. Letters of support from Resolve, the Minnesota Bar Association, the American Bar Association, and the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. In Minnesota, surrogacy has been happening since 1988. And we basically have no laws on this. I served on a task force along with Steve Schneider here next to me several years ago when the Department of Human Services had a lengthy task force which looked into this issue. I just want to repeat, we have nothing in state law about this. So what's happening now is people who want to go through a surrogacy arrangement basically do it on their own and don't have all the prerequisites that are listed in my legislation here. So there have been a couple of issues that have gone to the courts, and with this legislation in place, we could alleviate that situation. And actually, what this legislation would do would be put a process in place where we think would screen out any potential problems that could happen down the line. So just real briefly, the purpose of the bill is to establish consistent standards and safeguards to protect all parties in a surrogacy arrangement and to confirm the legal status of a child born as a result of these arrangements. In the audience today are some people that have undergone surrogacy or are in the process, and right now there's so many legal things that they have to hop through to make sure that this works. We want to put some good safeguards in place so that we as legislators are deciding the process, instead of a judge randomly who isn't really necessarily familiar with this issue. Part of this legislation is where the intended mother is the mother of the child immediately upon the birth of the child, the intended father is the father of the child immediately upon the birth of the child, and neither the gestational carrier nor her husband is the parent of the child upon the birth. And this legislation lays out comprehensive laws that define contract, duty to support, establishment of parentage, effects of subsequent marriage, immunities, and further legal rights under the contract. So I'd like to turn it over to Steve Snyder, who will give you a brief update of what this legislation is, and then we'll stand for questions.
Mr. Snyder.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Representative. I am Steve Snyder. I'm an attorney that's been practicing law in this area for all of the 20 years. I probably did the first surrogacy case with a referee in Hennepin County in 1988. I'm here on behalf of Resolve, which is a national infertility advocacy education and support group. It has representation of 7.2 million infertile couples nationally and the 145,000 plus infertile persons that are your constituents. I'm also here as a representative of the Minnesota State Bar Association Family Law Section and as the chair of the American Bar Association Genetic and Reproductive Technologies Committee. The main purpose of this act is gender equity in infertility. Minnesota supports third-party assisted reproduction. And what I mean is, if a couple is missing one of the components to have a child, whether it be sperm, egg, or uterus, Minnesota has said that in the case of sperm, which covers male infertility, that they can automatically and administratively be established as a parent. This act brings that to those people suffering from other types of female infertility, this act in particular for uterine infertility. As Representative Tingelstad said, it sets forth eligibility requirements for the participants to make sure only the right people are participating in these types of procedures, eligibility issues for the intended parents, and reasonable and responsible procedures to go through. It has, in your packet, been approved by all of the membership of Resolve National, by the Minnesota State Bar Association unanimously, by the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers unanimously, and on February 11th in Los Angeles, California, the American Bar Association approved its Model Act for Assisted Reproduction, and of 500-plus delegates in their House of Delegates at that meeting, they approved that Model Act, which includes this act as its alternative to govern gestational carrier, unanimously, from all states, conservative, liberal, or otherwise. So it has the approval and broad-based support of all of the bar associations, and it is virtually identical to a statute that has been in force and working effectively in Illinois since January 1st of 2005. I believe that it will lead to judicial economy, which I think is a huge issue as a fiscal note for this committee. Judges currently have to hear up to 3 separate files. Administrative staff and courts have to open up to 3 separate files in order to complete a surrogacy. If there is an unrelated intended mother and an egg donor is used, there has to be a paternity matter, a voluntary termination of the surrogate's rights, and a step-parent adoption. This would take all of those procedures out of the court system and let the court system work on the cases that are much more important than these and where the intent of the parties is not so expressly stated. It is fair, it is equitable for the gender, and I ask for the committee support.
Representative Tingelstad, did you have one more witness?
Yes, Dayana De Poyser would just like to say a brief comment and support.
My name is Dayana De Poyser. I'm with Resolve. I'm the advocacy chair for the Midwest region, and we have a letter, 2 letters, one from national and one from our local group that supports this legislation, and I just ask you to do the same. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tingelstad.
Questions?
And we'll, before questions, we'll have the...
I just want to make a statement when you're done.
Before the other side? Oh, okay. Is there any one testifying on this bill otherwise? Curtis Hybert and Tom Pritchard. Do you want to come down?
Are we talking, excuse me, Chairman, are we talking about House File 3349 or 3348?
We're talking about 3448, Mr. Pritchard. Are you on this or are you on 3449?
Both.
Okay. We'll give about roughly 8 minutes to the two of you, then, which should make it equal to their time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Curtis Herbert. I'm an attorney in private practice in the state of Minnesota. I'm not representing anybody in this matter. I think the good intent and goodwill of the parties that are involved in surrogacy arrangements, the altruism, I don't think that's doubted. The issue here is if the state wants to commoditize baby making. Let's recall how this surrogacy arrangement works. I give you the money and you give me the baby. That's what's required. Now, there is altruism in some cases, but what we're talking about here is a statutory system that sets up, that cues up and embraces that paradigm. This opens the way to a new eugenics. Right now, you can go to your university newspapers, you can Google egg donor. You'll find that, $5,000 to $10,000 to donate eggs, the woman genetic component is reasonable. If you have a college degree, you'll get more money. If you're blonde, get more money. If you have special talent, these places can look like online dating services. And that's fine if you want to commoditize this reproductive process. Now, if you reject this bill, it puts you in good company with very progressive nations. Europe largely bans these agreements. I mean, you're being asked to embrace a statutory paradigm that's too far out for Sweden and France and Germany. The exception in Europe is the UK, which bans compensation, meaning money beyond direct expenses to the surrogate mothers, the baby carriers. So UK, you jump through their hoops, you can't pay compensation to the surrogate mother. Many US states ban or even criminalize these arrangements. Many do allow it. However, none of these states have statutes that embrace compensation. Now, there are some states that have drifted into compensation through judge-made law, like California. In a vacuum of statutory law, judges, they decided, let's enforce these contracts and let's let the money change hands, that's fine. But there isn't any state in a country that used statutory law to embrace the payment of compensation. Now, you could look at a couple of these statutes and perhaps quibble with that statement, but I think it's an accurate generalization. Now, just let me, certainly some states don't, they know that compensation takes place, their statutes are silent on that, and they let it go forward. But you would be the first legislature that passes the law and says, hey, this is a great idea, let's do this. Now, one of the problems with the surrogacy arrangement, and I'm trying to be concise and bring this to a conclusion, Mr. Chair, thank you for your patience. One of the problems is that we're bypassing adoption law. We just listened to a very technical kind of amendment, the adoption statute, but what we're talking about here is, look, no home visits, can't buy a baby through adoption, but, whatever you want to pay here, no problem. Background checks. So it's best interest of the child. We've got the adult desires controlling in this situation. because there are very significant emotional stakes, you know, if you're an infertile couple, but we need to look beyond that to the other issue. And so, finally, there's some other technical problems with the 3448 in that section 11 eviscerates the safeguards by allowing enforcement of the contract despite noncompliance. And I'll let Mr. Pritchard speak, if Mr. Chair, if that's...
Yes, he has about 3 minutes left.
Okay, Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Pritchard, President of Minnesota Family Council, and we strongly oppose this legislation. We feel that this is not compromise language legislation, but it's really far out there. As Mr. Herbert alluded, the European countries universally do not allow compensation. In many cases, most cases, they ban this sort of practice. And in the United States, we would be on the far edge of this. This is, we'd be breaking new ground. And so I think we need to look very carefully at this legislation and what that means. We don't feel there are safeguards in place, and this bill goes far beyond just infertile couples. Now, that's what's been discussed. But if you look at the language, it talks about allowing in Section 4B2, it talks about medical need, which can be defined by a doctor. That is not, that can, you know, maybe a woman decides the pain or the prospective pain of childbirth is too much. Well, is that a medical need? I think that's a huge loophole. You know, the concerns already mentioned that fundamentally this is selling a baby. I mean, we have to realize that that's what's involved. I think the proponents argue, no, that we're just hiring the services of a woman. But the fact is, the money is transferred for the baby from the woman. And failure to provide the baby means that you can sue in court for specific performance. So this is fundamentally about baby selling. And I think people need to realize what's going on. I think it opens up the door to designer babies, to new eugenics. If you go out there and look on the market, they're asking for different characteristics. People buying eggs from women can get more money if they're a college graduate, they have blonde hair, different things like that. So we're opening the specter here of designer babies. And as I mentioned, there's no requirement that parents be unable to have children. And I think we're really redefining family. I think we're encouraging, there's no restriction. The original legislation several years ago talked about married couples. The idea, we want children to be raised ideally in a couple with in an arrangement with a mom and a dad. This has no requirement. Individuals, single individuals can go in and contract now. And so we're really treating children as commodities. And fundamentally, that's not in the best interest of children. Nowhere in this legislation are there safeguards for children. What are the best interests of children? You know, what's the best home for a child? Because in a sense, you've got an adoptive sort of arrangement where you've got two independent parties working to bring children together. And we feel that this undermines the adoption process. And I'll conclude with that. It undermines it because it circumvents it. Why would a couple go out and adopt a child now or take a child from foster care if they know they can create the ideal baby and avoid all the hassles of that? And so we're concerned about that. Thank you.
I represent Health from your first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually want to first thank Representative Tingelstad for her leadership and hard work on this. Many of you know that the baby M case in other states was exactly the problem that Minnesota is attempting to avoid in this situation. The law is currently silent on this, and currently these surrogacy relationships are taking place. And baby M is the example of how, when the state does not set rules in place, you end up with disastrous situations. I do take exception with the statement that if you give me the money, I will give you the baby, and that this is baby selling. These rules are an attempt to get away from something like that happening here in Minnesota. It has happened other places, and we need to make sure that our laws are in place to stop that kind of behavior so it doesn't happen here. And so, again, Representative Tingelstad, I think you've gone a long way in taking care of a very, very difficult issue. And let's not pretend that these aren't happening here. They are. And so we can either set some standards or we can have none, and they'll continue on as they have been in the past.
Representative Heitman and then Member. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a very good segue from Representative Hilton. We could go another way, too, and that is to just make this stuff illegal and maybe even criminalize it. And I'm wondering if both testifiers could tell the committee whether they would prefer, if they were voting out a bill, would they want this to be illegal and or criminal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, my view is I think the contract should be made void as a matter of public policy, so they should not be enforceable. Because I think what's happening is you're setting up a market here, and you're going to be encouraging the practice. And I don't think we want to go that route. Maybe one example of where to go is where Michigan's gone. They don't allow compensation. If there are disputes, I think they will go to the courts in terms of the best interest of the child. And I think they do sanction those performing agreements. They don't sanction the individuals. So in a sense, they allow it to occur. But, I mean, we're moving away from this notion of this they talk about altruistic surrogacies, where basically, you know, a woman can't conceive, so maybe her sister, you know, will take the, you know, allow the, you know, IV and so forth, to a situation. This is wide open now in terms of who can do it for what reasons. We're really throwing it in the market. So I think, I'm probably not where you're suggesting, maybe, you know, and totally criminalizing everything about it, but I think this goes way too far the other direction.
Representative Simon. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Herbert, you care to weigh in? Would you, and if you could wave a magic wand, would you want these arrangements, would you want surrogacy arrangements to be unlawful or even criminal?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I would embrace the approach pursued by Michigan, which responded to the Baby M case by passing legislation that didn't punish, it didn't criminalize the parties involved in these arrangements, so it's not criminal behavior. But it refused to enforce them, and in the case of disputes, it looked to the best interest of the child.
Mr. Chair, just to continue, well, okay, those are fair arguments. I think that, I agree with them, but they're fair arguments. I think, as Representative Hilton said, this is already happening, and we've got the wild, wild west out there. And the question is, do we want to pretend it's not happening or wish it weren't happening, or do we want to acknowledge it's happening and place some safeguards? I think we can all disagree reasonably about what the safeguards should be or how we should, put into practice something that would give people rights, enforceable rights, either way. But I guess I err on the side, as Representative Tinkelstedt has and as the people she's collaborated with have, of putting in place a structure so that people at least know where they stand. Because right now, it's just the OK Corral out there, and nobody knows where their rights are, if they have any at all.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and Representative Simon, just to follow up on that. I think he did give you the solution, and it's the Michigan solution. The point here is that this is currently legal, and parties are allowed to contract right now. I have some questions for the author, Mr. Chairman, and specifically, I heard Mr. Schneider testify that all these wonderful lawyers have approved this. The ADA, by the way, also took a position several years ago in favor of abortion. So I don't know that that's a big help to me. I'm not sure why we want to do this, Representative Tinkelstedt, because it looks like you're creating bureaucracy on top of bureaucracy. If you could turn to page 2 and look at subdivision 13, it defines medical evaluation. And then if you go back to your section 5, requirements for a gestational carrier contract, could you explain to the committee first what the medical evaluation or evaluations would entail, whether there would be one or more specialties, and exactly what is going to be evaluated?
Representative Tinkelstedt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Emmer. Well, there's already things in place and very stringent requirements through the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, American College of OBGYN, and actually there's people in the audience that can respond to that as well. But to your point about amount of bureaucracy, this actually reduces the amount of bureaucracy, because right now there's several judicial things happening that would not need to occur. And what we believe is that there would be probably fewer surrogacy arrangements in Minnesota, because people would have specific outline of what they need to do to go through the process. The eligibility, this is pretty much things that are adopted with other states, and what's happening right now, you know, as far as the age of the person, the surrogate having given birth to at least one child, and so forth. And so these things would be spelled out so that there would probably be fewer people actually undergoing the process, and we think more successful ones that actually do go through the process, because they've thought through the entire thing before any of the medical stuff occurs.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Emmer. So Representative Tingle said, you didn't answer my question. If you look at Section 5, Sub 5, and by the way, you're telling us that this would limit the bureaucracy. Well, Mr. Schneider there testified that right now a court has to open three files, and I'll submit to you that this does not resolve that at all. If you turn, in fact, to page 8 before I take you to the bureaucracy that I was actually referencing, it's interesting to note that despite all of this, these wonderful details that you are citing us to and how this is going to limit things, you have a provision on irrevocability, and it says that any challenge to the rights of parentage may be commenced within 12 months from the date of birth of the child. So it would seem to me that if you're going to enforce this this contract, which, by the way, we can already create, parties can already contract to do what you're talking about, and you would have the same file that's open if somebody complains that the contract's been breached or somebody didn't perform. But now you've also put into law the right to revoke within 12 months. And if you back up, you also look on page 6 at the top. It refers to the gestational carrier's agreement to abstain from activities, which would include, without limitation, smoking, drinking alcohol, using non-prescribed drugs, using prescription drugs. And the note that I wrote in the margin was, all right, so we enter into one of these agreements, and there's an argument that the gestational carrier it had some impact on the fetus, such that you have a baby that's born with birth defects, and now we have to initiate another court action to revoke the gestational carrier agreement. It seems to me that while you appear to have put in a lot of work on this, the argument that this is going to somehow limit disputes is probably not the case. So if you go back to page 5, you say you haven't created more bureaucracy, but look what we've created here. We've created an independent escrow agent, who I would imagine the parties can agree upon now, but now it's going to be in law and it's required. You've created one or more medical evaluations, and I will note for the record that even though you say this is all spelled out somewhere, it's not referenced in this this bill. You've also got a requirement in here for mental health evaluations, and that's plural. Is it going to be just the gestational carrier? Is it going to be the donor, the sperm donor? Is it going to be the intended parent? Are we going to have it with a psychiatrist, a psychologist? What's the standard? I don't think this is, in fact, I can see why all of the lawyers have approved it, because it looks like a full employment act for lawyers. The question, I guess, because you can tell I probably have more questions than I'm ever going to get answers, if you could go back to page 2 and explain to me why you have in subdivision 11, in the case of a married couple, why did you put that language in your bill?
I represent Tinglestad.
Mr. Chair, may I respond?
Mr. Schneider.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, the reason for that is that gestational carrier agreements are often entered into, I would say, in 90%+ of the cases by married couples, people who are using their own egg and their own sperm, who can't have their own genetic child, without the kind assistance of a gestational carrier who is not genetically related, and that is one of the requirements of this act. However, there are also people who enter into these agreements who are not married, heterosexual couples who have not chosen to get married, or single persons. And since these agreements are being entered into by such people, that reference in Subdivision 11 is made to make sure that we capture those people within the purview of the Act. Just to respond briefly to some of your other questions, first of all, the cases that you referred to in the courts that could happen based on harm to the child or dispute over parentage exists currently. So by removing in the 99.5% of cases where there is no dispute in surrogacy, which is a documented fact through the American Bar Association statistics, that the paternity, step-parent adoption, and irrevocable or the revocation of the surrogate's rights don't need to occur, we're still taking many, 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 many more cases out of the system than we're leaving the system exposed to. The mental health and medical evaluations are being done. They're obstetric evaluations to make sure that the surrogate can safely carry another pregnancy so there's no risk to her or the child. The American Obstetric and Gynecological Association is used as the standards because those are the standards currently being applied. Mental health evaluations is plural because it applies as a requirement of the Act for eligibility to both the surrogate and the intended parent. In terms of the escrow of compensation, that's an important provision because if you agree to a surrogacy contract without professional structure and the parents say, we will reimburse these medical expenses, we will reimburse these legal expenses, but they don't put into escrow the money to do so in advance and the surrogate gets pregnant and then the couple says, well, gee, we don't have the money, it creates a problem. So these are all safeguards and procedures that are already done in real life in every case. And they work out wonderfully. They've been implemented in Illinois successfully for 3 years, and I think it's the appropriate structure for this in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Emmer.
I appreciate your response, Mr. Schneider. 99.5 don't have any dispute, and we currently allow this. I appreciate that information because it confirms my concerns. And again, this is for the author. Representative Tingelstad, why do you have in Subdivision 11 in the case of a married couple? Because the overwhelming amount of scientific evidence indicates and establishes that a child who is raised in a family, a traditional family with a mother and a father, is way ahead of the ballgame. And this suggests, even though I know Mr. Schneider has told us that 90% of these involve a married couple, a traditional married couple, or heterosexual relationships, this suggests that it opens it up to any type of arrangement, and the one that I'm concerned about most is the single person who decides that they want to buy a baby. That's what I'm concerned with, and I know you've already testified that's not your intent, but doesn't that open it up, and why did you put this language in there?
Mr. Schneider, or is it...
No, this is for Representative Tingelstad, Mr. Chairman.
I think, Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, as Mr. Schneider testified, 90% of these are with married couples, and we're looking at what's currently being done in Minnesota and based on other states and putting this situation in place. I mean, this legislation, we believe, reflects what's happening in society. And as you know, not all couples are married. And so this puts some things in place that are according to what's going on in society. And so we think it's appropriate that it be here.
Mr. Chair, I'd ask for a roll call vote when this is voted on. Thanks.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Mr. Snyder, very quickly.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I just want to say two things. First of all, the testimony about Minnesota being a free radical on the fringe is not accurate. There is a handout in the committee's packet that references chronologically all surrogacy law that's been passed anywhere in the nation to date. In the last 15 years, not one state has passed any negative or restrictive legislation. Three states expressly by statute allow compensation. Illinois, because that's the statute after which this is modeled, and Texas and Utah, who have adopted the Uniform Parentage Act, which also allows for compensation. Texas, I would say, would be a good state to look at in terms of atmosphere. And finally, from the baby-selling perspective, on that same page in the last 15 years, two states, West Virginia and Oregon, have recognized that surrogacy is not baby-selling and has expressly exempted it from its baby-selling statute.
Representative De La Force. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And a question for the author and maybe the witness. Is it possible, and I'll cut to the quick in the interest of time, is it possible to craft one of these surrogacy agreements and have a clause within that says, for whatever reason, perhaps it's the severe a birth defect or something, that under those circumstances, you as a gestational carrier agree to terminate pregnancy? Is it possible to write that into one of these contracts?
Mr. Snyder.
If your bill were to become law.
Mr. Snyder.
Mr. Chair, Representative De La Force, no, it is not. In fact, the gestational carrier agreements that are drafted expressly acknowledge the carrier's right to control the pregnancy under Roe v. Wade, which is a constitutional right which cannot be waived. So contractually, the intended parents can make it an agreement with the surrogate that they discuss in advance, but the actual legal control over the pregnancy remains with the carrier, okay, even in the face of this statute.
Okay. Then, Mr. Chairman, is the corollary true then? Is it always possible then for the gestational carrier to terminate the pregnancy because of the constitutional guarantees that currently exist within the framework of Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Gomez and their progeny? Is that true?
Is that fair? Representative De La Force, yes, that is true.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chairman, I have one quick follow-up then. Under this bill, then, is there some type of right of redress then by the intended parent? If for whatever reason the gestational carrier just decides one day, I'm terminating this pregnancy, I'm out of here, then what rights of redress do the intended parents have?
Mr. Snyder.
Mr. Chair, Representative De La Force, they have the same rights for breach of contract that they would have in any other contract. So if there are expense reimbursement or compensation provisions, they can treat it as a breach of contract and affect the payments to the surrogate. One other thing is there is a Minnesota Court of Appeals case on the books regarding surrogacy. It's an unpublished opinion in PGM versus JMA, and the Court of Appeals has held A, surrogacy contracts are enforceable in Minnesota, and B, a non-genetically related surrogate is not the legal or biological mother of the child. So we're already dealing with law in that regard.
Okay, we're going to vote on this. All in favor of... I'm sorry. There's a roll call.
Representative Bigham.
Aye.
Representative Cornish.
There's no guns involved.
Representative De La Force.
No.
Representative Emma.
No.
Representative Kjellstrom.
Aye.
Representative Holberg.
No.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Kalin.
Aye.
Representative Calls. Representative Kranz.
Aye.
Representative Lesch. Representative Lilly. Representative Owen. Representative Tamar.
Aye.
Representative Saylor.
Aye.
Representative Simon.
Aye.
Representative Smith. Representative Westrum.
Aye.
Representative Mullery.
Aye.
Representative Westrum.
Yes. Okay. 9-4. 9-4. 9-4. The bill passes
9-4. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you very much. Tinglefed, Representative Tinglefed, there's one more bill. Hopefully we can do it quickly. Representative Hellstrom, do you want to move? Representative Hellstrom?
I'll move the bill, Mr. Chair.
No, Representative Hellstrom moves 3449. Representative Tinglefed, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is fairly brief, so it should go quickly.
In Minnesota law right now, it only deals with infertility as it relates to the male factor infertility. With this legislation, it would bring the female factor infertility in. And again, these situations have been happening in our state for over 20 years. The law that we have is very archaic. And Mr. Snyder can give us a brief update, and then I think it's ready for questions.
Mr. Snyder.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the existing artificial insemination statute was passed in 1982. At that time, that was the only type of assisted reproduction medically possible. Since then, retrieval of eggs and in vitro fertilization have allowed egg donor situations to occur and have resulted in the storage of embryos, which many people wish to transfer onto other infertile couples to save them costs. There is no legal procedure which facilitates parentage to be established when eggs are donated or embryos are donated. I believe that those are in the same category as sperm in terms of the ability to benefit an infertile couple by transferring the gametes. So it simply updates the existing statute by bringing egg and embryo donation under its purview. And the only other significant change is that because 65% of these procedures are currently done by single women or unmarried heterosexual couples, we have expanded the language to remove the married heterosexual couple requirement and make sure that all people that are using donor sperm or donor egg are established as the parents. The donors are protected from child support proceedings. The child has certain parentage established without possibility of dispute, and it administratively makes the system efficient and equitable according to gender.
Is there any other testimony, Representative Tinglestad, for you? Okay. Then is there any opposition? We'll give, they only got 2 minutes. We'll give you about 3.5 max. Mr. Pritchard, go ahead, or whoever wants to go. You two decide between your time, about 3 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'd like to correct my previous testimony. If Mr. Snyder says that Texas, Illinois, and Utah allow compensation, I would have to say I don't know if they do or not. And I would apologize to this committee if my research is out of date.
Okay. Go ahead on this, Bill.
My name is Curtis Herbert. I'm attorney in private practice for the record, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
Thank you.
With respect to Bill 3449, it submits the purpose of this bill is to bypass adoption laws by specifying that clients that contract for childbearing by surrogate parents are made legally the parents at birth. So that's it. There's no home visits, no background check, no best sisters of the child for the most part. And this is not about creating equality in gametes donation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Mr. Pritchard.
Tom Pritchard, President of the Family Council. The concern I have is it talks about donation of sperm and eggs, and unfortunately I think it's become a commodity. And I think the legislation needs to clarify that a donation does not mean compensation beyond the actual expenses. And if I was mistaken in my last testimony about certain states, you know, I stand corrected too. But the concern we have is the compensation for the eggs and the sperm. You know, if there are actual expenses, that's one thing. But when you get into compensation, you get these ads. That's where you get into exploitation, I think, of women, low-income women particularly, who are told, hey, you can make a lot of money, big money, $10,000, $20,000 for your eggs. And so I think that needs to be changed in, or clarified in the legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. I saw the name of a member of my parish used to be Jo Tolk. Is she here this time? Okay. Okay. Then there's any questions from the committee on this bill? No, Representative LaForce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And a question maybe for Mr. Schneider, unless this is the witness arriving. I'll withhold my question.
Yes, my name is Charity Roberts. Mr. Chairman, Representative, in regards to egg donation, I don't believe that the compensation is is being portrayed correctly. You're looking at somebody who's putting in a lot of time and energy and medication and a lot of trips to be monitored. And I think that, that the compensation is really being overplayed just because that's not what it is.
Okay, thank you. Representative LaFleur.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, maybe a question for Mr. Schneider. In reviewing House File 3449 this morning, I had an opportunity to open up Chapter 257, the Parentage Act, and I wasn't able to find it. Where can I find a definition of partner, which appears to be central to the thrust of this bill in changing the definition from husband or father and the like to partner? Where is that defined?
That is not defined at this time, Representative.
Thank you. And Mr. Schneider, Mr. Chairman, in members, one of the fundamental obligations I believe that we all have as representatives holding an election certificate is to create clarity for the people who follow the laws that we make. I fear that by passing this bill, whether or not partner bothers you or not from your societal point of view, we're not helping the courts and we're not helping the people who are going to open up the statute books looking for guidance on the subject if it's not defined. To my mind, we're shirking our fundamental duty. It's a dereliction duty. We're just sort of punting onto the courts and to people who are going to open the statute book looking for guidance for us on this particular issue. And I therefore think Representative Tingle said that this particular bill is fatally flawed, not from any type of worldview and how you feel about relationships between people, but the fact that there's utterly no definition for partner, which is central to this bill. And so I think that this bill isn't ready for prime time unless some type of attempt is made in this committee, I believe, because it's our jurisdiction, to try and define partner. It's just unworkable.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Schneider.
Mr. Chair, Representative DeLaForce, the effect of this bill is to state that given its natural dictionary definition, a partner is someone who is coupled with someone else. There are many types of relationship in our society. The problem with the existing artificial insemination statute, even if this bill isn't passed, is that it only establishes reliable parentage for children born to married heterosexual couples. And that is not the majority of people using sperm donation. So we have a whole class of children whose parental status is not established, and that extends to all children the result of egg donation or embryo donation. This statute requires the written consent of the woman's partner or the partner, the married person's partner, that explicitly states that they intend to be the parent of the child. So there will be two consents. They will be from the woman and her partner, whoever that is, and I don't think an additional partner, whoever that is, and I don't think an additional statutory definition is necessary in order to make this statute efficient and workable.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just follow up, as I said, our charge here, Mr. Schneider, is to try and create clarity and give guidance to the people we serve. This doesn't do it. I heard you use phrase like whatever that might mean, or you offered a definition, more of a dictionarial type of definition for partner. There's absolutely not even any guidance within the bill with respect to that. What happens when a parenting issue ends up in court and the judge has got to open up the statute books, they're going to see the word partner, and then the immediate question that is begged is, what in the heck does that mean? And we're offering absolutely no help to people. And as you know, what's going to have to happen if we pass this bill is years down the road, a body of decision authority is going to have to develop at the Supreme Court level if we're going to have uniformity in Minnesota, whenever it might get there, and the folks on the Minnesota Supreme Court decide they even want to take a writ to take up the issue in the first place. I just think it is wrong as a representative here to pass a bill of that nature and to sort of punt the ball. I don't think we're helping anybody who has to then go to the courts and rely upon the courts to try and make law instead of interpret it.
Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'll start with Representative Tingleton, but following up a little bit on Representative DeLaForce, but not even from the legal clarity standpoint. What about the, I guess I'm looking at it from the social side of the word partner around this place in the last couple of years has become synonymous with same-sex marriage. So, if we don't define it, it seems to me that's the road we're going down. Give me comfort that that's not what this is doing, is making it easier or going down the road of encouraging more unwed children with no structure, family structure in place. Because I don't think we would agree that our societal problems have gotten better because we've had less family cohesion in marriages in this state. Can you address that concern of mine?
Well, Representative Westrom, just to start off, I don't know that we're trying to encourage unwed children, but Representative Tinglestad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Westrom, I'm seeing that this bill probably needs some more work, and I know this is deadline time, and I appreciate the committee's time today, so I think it's probably best to just table this bill at this time.
Okay, thank you, Representative Tinglestad. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Mr. Chair, members.
Okay, all, is there a motion to adjourn? No? No motion to adjourn?
Yeah, ready?
Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.